in New York, in fact, I'm writing a piece on this now. In New York, there's a place called Le Petit Puppy. And what's really funny about Le Petit Puppy is that you can go and watch all these women or gay men, typically, who are going to look at the puppies because the puppies are so cute. And then you can watch all the women or gay or the men or gay men or women who are there to like just to pick up the people looking at the puppies. Because what if you're like looking at a puppy and then you look up, you're basically looking at the love of your life because the puppies trigger oxytocin. And then there's a bench that's there to like for people who just want to watch people picking up people who are looking at puppies. And so what's funny about that story is that that's a space story, actually. It's like it's you've got a little unseen ecosystem. You think it's just cute puppies, but it's way more sophisticated than that.
I love that.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Fred, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I found out about your book by way of your publicist, Making Conversation, which, you know, in the time we're living in, obviously is a subject of tremendous interest to me and of tremendous importance. But before we get into all of that, I want to start asking what I think is a very fitting question, given the nature of your work. And that is, what social group were you a part of in high school? And what impact did that end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
That's a great, great question, because it's one that I often ask to kind of warm people up. Is I'll often ask them, like, who were they in when they were 12? Because I think it's a way to kind of really begin to see a different side of a person. But I'll give you a really straight up honest answer. So I was a gay kid. My father was the headmaster of my school, and I had to live a fairly closeted existence. So I dated the cheerleader. Played soccer. I also did theater at the same time. And I had to run away, basically. I did a structured running away to come out. And so I came out for a year and then went back to school and came back to school and then went back in the closet. And what's interesting about that is that I thought that I was like the weirdo, not popular kid. When I went back to my 25th anniversary, everyone was like, you were the one that held everybody together. Like you were the one who was always crossing cultures between different kinds of people. So it was sort of an interesting like retro perspective, which I didn't have at that time. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously it raises more questions, but how old were you when you realized you were gay? And what is that experience like, you know, when you're going through adolescence in contrast to, you know, being an adult? Where you're completely open about it and out of the closet?
Well, I have a sense now, I have a sense that I actually knew I was gay since I was very, very, very young. Like, I think my first crush was Fred from Scooby-Doo. Which you don't probably even know who he is, but it's like, but he was like this cartoon character. And so, I think I came to various levels of acceptance. Finally, what happened is that when my father left the school and my mom had this kind of severe stroke, I realized that I no longer had the pressure to be the perfect child because I was also the oldest son. And so I did this funny thing, which is that I spent a day pretending that I was gay. I basically tried on the idea that I was gay. And I spent a whole day walking around San Francisco, like going to gay bookstores, like talking to people. And it came out of it feeling just so emboldened and so strong by it that I actually, I was like, I'm gay and it's time for me to come out. And so I did that. That's actually, by the way, the reason I ended up being, I think I told you I was homeless for a while because like my then, you know, partner kicked me out of the house because she was so furious for good reason. And I now tell people when they're going through really hard things. Like I have a friend who recently was like, she's a CEO of a company, but she's being, I would say frankly bullied. And I basically was like, try pretending for a day that you're not there and that you're not the CEO of the company and see how you feel. And she did that. And it allowed her to basically say, yeah, I'm quitting. So that's sort of a long way of going. I will also say being gay politicized me, you know. So as you know, I worked with ACT UP, not a very satisfying way, but you know, politics have always been embedded in the notion of my existence, just because, you know, during the 80s, I was pretty sure, even though I was closeted, that I would never probably ever sleep with a man because of my fear of AIDS. And remember, we thought of that as genocide at the time. You know, that's the way we characterize the disease. So it's affected me in probably every aspect of my being.
So, you know, I've asked this question to people who have been on the show or are also gay. Like, when you come out, particularly to your closest friends and more importantly to your family, what is that experience like? And is it one of acceptance? Because I just had this guy, Stephen Goldstein, here, who was actually our episode that we aired on Monday of this week. And he, you know, is a political consultant. He actually wrote this amazing book called The Turn On, How the Most Powerful People from Washington to Wall Street to Hollywood Make Us Like Them. And his experience was like quite traumatic. Like, he never sort of had any sort of reconciliation with his family, which I found so sad. But at the same time, I know that that's reality. Like, I think, you know, particularly with Indian parents, if you told them you were gay, that would definitely create a rift in the family. So what is that experience like, or was it like for you?
Well, so my mother was quite accepting. I never really told my father. Like, it's like, I wasn't that close to my father. So I kind of like, I never could. My mom found out because a picture of me kissing my boyfriend fell out of my book. And so she was like, moms do what they do. Like, I always knew this is what the case was. And, but so that wasn't hard. Like, if I were to be completely honest, you know, coming out to my partner, who frankly, you know, we were married. It's like, it was the hardest thing. Like, I felt like I really, really, really hurt her. We're now quite close, but that was a really hard thing. And I had been sleeping with men during that time. So ironically, liberal Berkeley, daughter of therapists, really open to sexual experimentation, but she was livid, and for good reason. You know, it's like, so like that's part of what got us to married in general. But then I will say that, and it's part of this notion of making conversation, I have carried it openly for the rest of my life. So I would be in the South in a very kind of radically religious organization that I would be working with, and I would talk about being gay openly at dinner. And what I find is that if you're kind and warm and reasonably smart, and you talk about things you want, like children or whatever, people start to identify regardless. And so I believe that there really is a need to be having the openness in the conversation. It's a brave thing to do. And, you know, I've certainly been in situations where people have threatened me. And yet at the same time, I'm like, it is my responsibility to make it clear that I'm a gay man.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy because, like, I mean, the roommate I live with now after 6 years of being married, you know, found out his wife was gay. And I remember when he came over to tell me, I was like, holy shit, how do you even process that? You know, so it was kind of, I mean, he's, you know, incredibly self-aware and I think self-actualized enough that he's done remarkably well with processing it. But, you know, after 6 years, like, it is something that, it, you know, definitely shakes you, because I think that particularly if you're married, you know, your entire future gets erased.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And you believe that it's one of those classic things. And it's actually like, even as we live post-election, it's one of these things where it's like, you feel like you're never gonna get past something, right? And then you do get past it. And then it's like, and the next thing that you think you'll never get past, and yet you do get past it. And so it's really this kind of like, that's what life is just kind of like always somehow kind of figuring out a way to keep going. And so it's, and one of the things that about making conversation is that it helps us do that.
Speaking of getting past things, there were two things that I wanted to ask you about. I know that you at one point lost your brother and then your mother had this awful stroke. Like, how do you find resilience in moments like that to keep going? Because I think to me, you know, the thought of losing a parent or a sibling, like in my mind, those are probably the most tragic things that I will experience in my life.
Yeah. I mean, and a younger sibling, 10 years younger than me, who also, we had a very troubled relationship. So it was even sort of stranger. And he died in a fairly vicious and spectacular car accident. You know, I will say that, you know, at 24, when my mother, I was 24 when my mother had her kind of debilitating stroke, it really, there's a couple of interesting things that happened. I had to, at that point, to make to decide, was I going to be by her side for the rest of her life to help her, or was I going to be independent and live a life that was somewhat free, even though she was suffering. And that was a hard decision to make. And a lot of people don't make the same decision I made, right? Some people decide that they will stay by it. But I felt like, to be utterly honest, my parents had not really raised me when I was a child. Like I, for my first 10 years, I was raised by my great-grandmother, which was very impactful for me. At various points, I was farmed out to a really lovely Indian family, India from India. Like it's like who raised me. So like they didn't have much of a role in my childhood. And so I felt, so that's one thing. But then knowing that my mom had had a stroke and that her father had had a stroke at 30 and died, it puts a time limit on your life. So you basically are like, I better take the best advantage of this life as I possibly can. And what's interesting about that is you would think it definitely led me to be driven and ambitious. And I'm definitely that. But more importantly, it led me to be like, I need to talk to everyone. I need to get to know every human that I can, because that's the best way to understand this world. So that was a really powerful thing for me. And then the second piece about my brother, I will say, is that was in fact the hardest thing I've ever gone through. I mean, he called me on my birthday. He was in a car accident within hours afterwards. It wasn't my birthday, because my family could never get my birthday right. So they always thought my birthday was 2 days before. So I had to get to my parents were like, we can't identify his body. We're so unhappy. They were so destroyed. So I had to fly there, drive through an ice storm. It took us 2 days. And in the morning of my birthday, I had to go identify his body. And then this is probably too graphic for you. Sorry. It's like,
basically,
pry open the door of his car and find his bloody phone so I could actually get in contact with his people. And so that I thought I wouldn't get through. However, I have a friend who's like deeply, her parents died at a very young age. And her name is Deb, and she happens to be also one of my publicists, but she walked me through it like step by step, like everything to be like from like, here's how you can get his eyes donated, like here's how you can do whatever, to like here's how you're going to feel the next day, to here's. And what happened at that point is that it triggered this thing in me where my husband and I had been living in different cities. He'd been in Los Angeles, I'd been in San Francisco, but I've been mostly in Washington because I was working with the Obama administration a lot. And we were like, this is stupid. Why are we living separately? So we moved within a couple months, we moved to New York because we were like, I couldn't work in LA. He didn't like San Francisco. And so I was like, okay, then let's go to New York. That's how we ended up on the East Coast.
Yeah. Well, walk me through what led to writing a book about this, of all the things you could write a book about.
It's the only book that I could write about. Oh, that's actually not true. I have an idea for another book, which is making my agent crazy right now. She's like, just focus on the book you've got. There's a couple things. One was right after 2016 elections, I was working with the Surgeon General, the then Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. And he was about to issue a epidemic of anxiety and loneliness in America, which I think would have been a groundbreaking.
I've read his book. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, together. So he wrote that proposal for that book at the same time I wrote the proposal for my book, because I was working with Vivek on how to make town halls more cathartic. So literally, Vivek Shankaravendam, I think you might know who does Hidden Brain, and I did a conversation and then a Creative Tensions, which is a form of dialogue that I do at NBC, I mean, sorry, at NPR Studio One, like maybe a month or two after the, or a month, like right during the inauguration. And it had about 500 people from all kinds of political backgrounds, range of whatever. And we designed it so that, well, we actually originally designed it as a dating game, but it ended up being much more cathartic than that. We designed it so that like, it felt like the whole room went through a giant catharsis. And that was what we were going to roll out as part of his town halls, is instead of just doing town halls, we wanted these cathartic community building moments. And so I gave a lecture on the degradation of dialogue in America, because as you know from reading the book, I believe that we go back to the 40s, 1940s is kind of when we really saw the dialogue start to degrade. And my agent called me and was like, I think your book is, this is your book. So here's the last funny story about that. So I wrote the book, which was phenomenal. But when the book sold, my publisher was like, oh, your book right now is all about the degradation of dialogue in America. The book you have to write has to be an entirely optimistic account of how we can have the hardest conversations of our life using creativity. That's a different book, right? than what I thought. And so having to get to optimism took me 3 years of work. So it's like, and I'll be honest, I am relentlessly still optimistic, which I know you might be hard to believe given the moment we're in, because I've seen people get through the hardest conversations of their lives by just giving it a little bit of thinking and a little bit of design.
I think I love that, because I think you've just given me the title for our episode. But well, let's get into these seven essential elements. You know, I know that, like, you know, in each element, there's also obviously these sub elements, and it would take us like an entire day to go through all of them. But you talk about commitment, and you say conversations first, beliefs second. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, that's a tricky one, because I'll be honest, I'm not really a writer. This is the first book I've written, And I had a story coach who was instrumental in helping me do it. Like he was basically like a therapist. And then he would say, okay, write that in 800 words, you know, it's like, pardon me. I would give a lecture for Aspen about the book before it was written, like as I was trying to kind of work through some of the kind of structures. And one of the questions that got thrown at me at the end, which of course should have come at me at the beginning, was, yeah, but how do you talk to people who hate you, or just disagree with you, or don't want to talk to you? And I was like, I don't know. And so I made this up. I was like, you need to just commit to the conversations and the people who are in the conversations first, and hold your beliefs second. And it turns out that's a hard thing to ask someone to do, but you can do it. And so, as you know, in the book, I went and looked at a bunch of organizations and places where people have committed to people who have wildly divergent beliefs from them. So there's, you know, I think one of my favorite stories in the book was the Dewey Academy, which is the story of the addicted teens. You know, I don't know if you remember that story, but these are teenagers now who are addicted to cutting. Boys are addicted to gaming and porn, and the girls are addicted to cutting. And, you know, it's like, it's very intense. And, but what's interesting about this Dewey Academy is that it's, doors are unlocked. The kids can leave at any moment. This is very unlike most other schools for addicted youth. And the only thing you have to do is say you're committed to being in the conversation and that you're committing to stay. And watching these, you know, 14, 15-year-old kids struggling with these huge issues from all walks of life, sitting in a room together and committing to helping each other, like constantly, watching their parents who were from even more divergent perspectives. So first generation Chinese parents who basically were like, you can't be addicted. Like, it's like, you know, whatever. It's like, but suddenly those families coming together and committing to each other was a remarkable experience. And so that's, by the way, that's not the same as having a conversation about politics, but it takes the same skills, which is like, it takes commitment. And it takes saying, like, we can be in this conversation together and we are going to be committed to you. And even if we disagree, like, I'm still there for you. And that's really the kind of core component of what commitment is all about, is kind of doing that. And then, as you know, because like the book is like this, it's like, commit until you can't, you know? So my other point on that is like, if you can't commit, then don't. And the conversation will be better off for it. Like, it's like, I have like far too many organizations where people are like, oh, I hate the organization, but it's important that I'm on their board because I'm the one who's continuously like challenging every new idea. And I'm like, yeah, no, maybe get off the board. It's like, because you're actually making it a lot harder for the rest of us who are really committed to this organization. So I mean, and it's the same thing. Like, if you I had a young Black woman who works in HR at a giant investing firm, and she was really asking me about triggering. Like, she's like, I noticed that there are certain things that trigger me, and how do I stay committed in a conversation where I've been triggered? And I told her the story that's in the book in the chapter on commitment of moving to New York. My husband wasn't there yet. We were on the fifth floor walk up of a loft in Tribeca. I'd literally had people just kind of like hauling furniture up the stairs all day long. You know, moving is really emotional. Like, I'm in New York. It's like, I'm like standing in the living room about to cry anyway. And someone comes pounding on the door and is screaming through the door. And I open the door, and it's this little, you know, I would say 5'4" woman. And she's like, just screaming. She's like, you've broken every rule of our building. Like, I've had to listen to your movers all day long. It's like, and like, you know, just the noise of you walking around up here is making me crazy. And I've lived in this building for 25 years. I'm going to have you like sued. And I just felt rage. Like, I was like, I could feel, because I was like, the trigger for me was like, I'm a wuss from California, and I'm going to just kind of capitulate to her and just say like, I'm so sorry, because that would be my first gut. And then, but I was so mad that I'd met this kind of quintessential nasty New York neighbor. And I was like, I'm being triggered. Like, I just took a breath and I was like, this is a trigger. And I turned to her and I said, is this the conversation you really want to have? And she stopped and she said, no, this is not the conversation that I want to have. And so we had this like lovely conversation where we talked about the neighborhood, we talked about things, and we became friends from then on out. I mean, like, she saved my life, no joke, during Hurricane Sandy, and just came and sat and drank wine with us for the whole night. So I think there's real value. And so that was a great example where I realized the trigger. I could have like easily ended the friendship that never, or would have never began a friendship, by just kind of like lashing back out, and we would have been at war for a long, long time. But by pausing, realizing I was being triggered, asking in essence for the conversation I wanted to have, which was a nice conversation, we were able to get there. So, you know, okay, even places where you feel like you can't commit, you can, if you're good, if you just try.
Well, so speaking of triggers, I think it makes a perfect segue to this idea of courage in conversation, but the trigger in particular, and I knew I wanted to ask you about this based on the content of your book. I think any one of us who has ever been in a relationship with a significant other, the moment you hear the words, we need to talk, you're like, fuck that. Like, I know where this is going. Like, this is going to be over and I don't want it to be. Like, I literally, every time, in my mind, I've always said, next time a woman sends me a text that says, we need to talk, I'm like, no, can you just finish the breakup now so we don't have to talk about this? So that, to me, that's the example that I think of, like, in a situation like, basically, how do I stop being triggered by that?
Yeah, I mean, so here's a funny thing. So it's like, my husband and I had an agreement that that when gay marriage became legal around all everywhere in America, that we would get married. So that happened. I happened to be in Aspen. This is just a little funny aside. I happened to be in Aspen. I had my whole team working with me. They were like, I was like, let's get to Tiffany's, let's get an engagement ring. Like, it's like, I want to be able to like ask him to marry me when I get back on July 4th, like on the pier of our farm upstate. And so I have all this work going. And then my husband texts me and he's like, hey, I guess we should get married. And so I started texting back being like, we need to talk. And like, literally the woman who was sitting next to me, one of my media people, grabbed my phone and was like, let me take care of this. You are not texting, we need to talk. When like, it's like, because it's like, because he's going to misread that. And so like, they took care of all my communications with my husband after that. So, so we have to be really, so one of the things we have to be careful is, first of all, don't text that. It's like, so it's like, just right off the bat, as you go into agreements with people who you're having relationships with, like, just like ask them, like, just if they're not going to, if they're going to text it, just call. Or don't. Like, it's like, that's the first thing. Like, that's kind of a bit, it's an act of aggression. To be honest, it might seem like it's you know, it's an act of great communication, but it's not. So that's the first thing you can do, is you can ask the people you're involved with and your friends and whatever, to just like, to if they ever want to talk to you, just to call and say, can we talk? I will also say that there are, in my world, I have a rule that when you say something like, I have feedback, or I need to talk to you, or I need to give you I have to tell you how I feel about something you've done. Once I do that, I always, and you probably might remember this from the book, I always then hand the power over to the person who I'm doing that to and say, what are the things that you feel like you just can't hear from me today? Or what are the things you just can't talk about? And so in a situation like that, like you could say, I can deal with anything. I just like, in the wake of the elections, I just can't hear you're going to break up with me today. It's like, you know, it's like, so, but that takes, that again, takes you and your partner, you and the person you're working with, kind of establishing the rules that basically say, like, if I'm going to give you feedback, I first hand you the rules to tell me what I can't give you feedback on. Right. So, And I have a question. Does every time someone says, do we need to talk? Is it because they want to break up with you?
Well, historically, yes. I mean, it's usually like, and it, you know, luckily it hasn't been, you know, via text, but still the moment I hear those words, I'm like in my mind, I like literally, I can just feel my heart start to race, you know, my breathing gets shallower, you know, like everything that you experience when you kind of know that, oh, okay. You know, I mean, the weird thing is I think for the most part, I've been the one to end all of the relationships that I've been in, and the ones that I didn't want to have end were obviously those situations. But I think that, you know, in my mind, I think I formed the association of those words and a bad outcome.
Well, yeah. And recognize the words themselves are right. We need to talk. Like, it's like, there's nothing wrong with the words. It's just that it's where they're placed is the problem. And so I would say full on embrace the fact that we all need to talk, but that's not the intent of what those words are in that circumstance. I mean, here's the other thing to do, which is that I talk about, you know, brave, and this, I think I told you, or in the book, you probably realize that it's like, I had the word brave tattooed over my heart when my brother died. Cause historically, chefs, he was a chef, they're overly tattooed. He was very much into tattoos. So as I was trying to think about something I could do that would pay tribute to him, so I put brave over my heart. And that was to remind me not to be brave, like go climb a mountain or, you know, fly solo over the ocean, like what I call like Amelia Earhart brave, but to be brave, like don't be afraid to stand up to the things when you see them happen. You know, and I have a friend who really believes the opposite, Mary Gentile, who has this incredible book called Giving Voice to Values. And her belief is that people don't identify as courageous. And I think that's probably true. And that's why I qualify it as everyday bravery. It's like the small acts of bravery. So, you know, I mean, what's the worst that happens? You hear some bad stuff, you know, it's like, and like I said, you'll get past it. You know, and it's like you'll make your life. It's like and I don't know. I have a history where everyone I've ever fired. This isn't exactly true with everyone I've ever broken up with. It's mostly true, but it's like or been broken up with but everyone I fire, we're still really good friends. Like it's like, and so it's like, so I think the testimony to the idea that like, even if I'm like saying you have to go, I'm still saying to you, but I'm committed to you. You know, it's like, I'm going to be there. Or I have people who I fired, but they like convinced me, let them come back for like a week, and were changed people. And like, are like, I was just on the phone with like one who's now like genius working at YouTube, doing like super amazing things. But it's like, but she was basically like my understudy, like at IDEO. And like, and, but when she left, I was like devastated, but I was like, awesome. Like, it's like you go be the most amazing thing you can be. So I would just say, like, it's like there's this notion of being a benevolent force in the world and just trying to help, which I think is embedded in this making conversation. You know, it's, last thing I'll say is I was really surprised when Adam Grant put it on his 30 books to read in the fall, But that's only because, like, I've known Adam Grant when he wrote Give and Get, because I think I texted him and I was like, hey, I really love this book. And so I didn't realize that Adam Grant was famous.
Adam's been a guest here. Adam is so nice.
Yeah. And so literally, I think I'm texting Adam at, like, during this thing being like, hey, I think it's to your credit that I had no idea that you had this kind of fame. And he's like, I think you're complimenting me. And I was like, yes, I'm complimenting you. I just thought he was just like some nice guy who just like was doing lots of nice things, you know? So,
but yeah. Well, let's get into the other elements. Talk to me about the concept of creative listening.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot in that. I will say that originally this came out of work I was doing at IDEO, and then kind of it's a hybrid of that and, frankly, my great grandmother is kind of like other things that and my mother that inspired me. So just to give you a sense, originally this came out of the work with IDEO where I felt like teams weren't listening anymore, like they were just typing. And I was like, you cannot be in a situation like this where you're not like paying attention to the social cues of what someone's saying to you, not just like writing down everything they're saying. And by the way, it's okay to take notes. It's okay to doodle. It's okay to knit. It's okay to do a bunch of different things while you're listening to somebody. Those make you better listeners. Typing doesn't make you a better listener. And there's scientific evidence around that. So I was like trying to get my teams to kind of stop listening. And I basically was like, oh, my mom was a really good listener. So I was like, my first thought was like, hey, listen like my mother or listen like your mother. And what I realized is that everyone's mothers don't listen the same way my mother listened. Like my mother was a tremendous listener, right? But that's because she was born in a family raised by her brother was deaf. Like it was mostly silent in that family because they wanted to respect the brother. And so she just became this phenomenal listener who then, of course, ironically, when she had her stroke, became aphasic, which made listening incredibly hard to do. And so that wasn't going to work. And so I felt like I had to kind of find more scientific methodologies or reasons why. So I went and looked at Quaker methodologies. I looked at of kind of listening to yourself and listening to the other person at the same time, that's why Quakerism lets women preach and always has. Is because like the idea is like that if God's been speaking to you, he's been speaking to you always. And so it sort of allows for the notion of, you know, have some judgment in a conversation. So not just that you're agreeing with somebody when you're listening. I looked at the practice of secrets and how short something can be. And I'll give you an example of that in a moment. And basically I mostly was looking at this as saying like, by the way, active listening, which is what's most frequently taught, the kind of like, go on, that kind of listening, which has been adopted by HR all around the world, basically, really sucks. Like active listening, I mean, apologies, you're having to listen to me more, but in this case, it's sort of like an interview, so otherwise we'd be more in conversation. But active listening comes out of Rogerian therapy, which was invented in like the 50s by this guy named Carl Rogers. Kind of a genius. He invented multiple therapeutic tools, this being one of them. And his belief was psychoanalysis and Freudian and Jungian therapies kind of assume that there's only one solution to somebody's problems, whereas he felt like there were a myriad solutions and only the individual could unlock what those solutions were. And so that's where Rogerian therapy began active listening. It was kind of like, you know, it would be like, are you unhappy? Or tell me how you're feeling. And then someone would say, well, I'm feeling unhappy. And they're like, well, why are you unhappy? And they're like, well, I'm feeling unfulfilled. And they're like, well, what makes you unfulfilled? And they would say, my job. And they're like, well, why are you in your job? And so it's like, that's kind of that would be it. That was active listening. And even that, you can tell, is just more, that's more sophisticated than saying, go on, that kind of listening. But when we started pulling that into like the business context, where it was really an excuse for employers not to have to listen to their employees, or you not to have to listen to me, or me not to have to listen to my husband, that's where it got really problematic. And so, and it's funny, I'm doing a lot of podcasts with a lot of people who are coaches and facilitators, and they're all so surprised by my rejection of active listening. And I'm just like, it wasn't meant for this. It was meant for something else. And you know, yeah. The book's pretty anti-methodology. It's like just make up your own way of doing it. You know, it's like, that's the smart way to think about it.
Well, it's funny you say that. Cause like, I think about how I interview people and it's not, you know, it's almost the opposite of that, you know, as opposed to, yeah, active listening. It's just, okay, I'm kind of following a thread of where you're taking this, but building questions as we go. So, yeah, I mean, in the interest of time, I want to cover all the other stuff here too. But we got to figure out a way to do it using constraints, ironically, but, you get into clarity, and I think that correct me if I'm wrong, but the summary in my mind of clarity was don't use jargon to describe things, because in every context, you know, you gave the example of a hospital, and you know, I think about my sister, you have this sort of language that you speak, and I know this because when I speak to authors or, you know, people who are in this field, we almost have this lexicon that to the outside world sounds like absolute nonsense. It's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Well, and ironically, clarity was, you know, publishers love C's, like seven C's. So originally clarity was actually called Talk Normal, because it was like, I was like, what's the best way to say? And originally the book was called Talk Normal. It's like, but my most embarrassing edit, the thing that my editors didn't catch is that if you notice in that first paragraph of clarity, I think I use the word obfuscates, like in that, and I was like, oh great. So start a chapter on clarity, and then you use the word obfuscate, like in the first thing. But yeah, I mean, you're getting it exactly right. However, I want to do a caveat. When your sister is talking to other healthcare workers about the safety and life of a patient, your sister should use any jargon or scientific language she needs to be able to communicate efficiently and fast to that person. So that's like, so what you don't want is a bunch of doctors who are like, get the heart circle pumper thing. You know, like, you know, like don't
right.
You know, it's like you want them to like say the word that everybody else is going to understand. That's like, it's like, you, like, don't stumble over like how to say something in a paragraph, so it's clear to, like, you know, clear to them. However, when a physician or an MD or someone is talking to you as a patient, they have to kind of like undo that kind of that specialized language and really be able to kind of speak in the most common language. So that is where you would say, again, I don't think it's as simple, it has to be as simple as it's not like trying to get to like using the 100 most common words, which is like, you know, a kind of funny little game you can play, but it's like, it can be like, you know, this stethoscope is going to, it lets me hear your heartbeat a little better. You know, it's like, just like explain what the language is. And then what you see is that hardcore, like, I'm going to go see a friend of mine who has, she's suffered from cancer for 4 years. And, you know, she knows this inside and out. Like, she knows the language by now, you know, so it's like, so she's taught herself it, but you know, there's some people who are the same thing who never learn it. So we have to amend ourselves based on how willing we are to go there. So yes. So the point here is really strive for clarity. Don't do it. But if you need it, if you need specialized language to kind of like, if you're like a oceanographer talking to an oceanographer, or a climatologist talking to a climatologist, pandemicist talking to a pandemicist, you do you. Like, that's fine. But if you're a pandemicist talking to the Movement for Black Lives, or if you're an oceanographer talking to your grandmother, like, it's like, then tone it down if you can. is basically the idea there. And then the last thing I would say is like, and then acronyms, those aren't words. So don't just dump them.
Okay. So let's talk about context. I think that, you know, to me, it's always interesting to talk to people, particularly those who worked at IDEO, when you think about space, because I've read all the IDEO books. I've read, you know, the design thinking book, the creative confidence theme book, and I am obsessive about the environments that I live and work in, because they affect the way that I work so much. But I think that, you know, looking at it through the context of conversation, I remember, we had Wallace Nichols, a guy who wrote a book called Blue Mind, and we were talking about water because we're both avid surfers. And he was kind of explaining to me that, you know, if you go near a body of water, it changes the context of the conversation. And so I was like, good to know. Every time I have a date from now on, I'll try to make sure it's near a body of water. And so, but I think the thing that really struck me most, and you know, if you can give us like a quick summary of this, because there's a couple other things I want to get to before, you know, we have to wrap things up. You talk about circles, reclining, standing up, and getting grounded. And it's funny because I'd heard the circle thing before from an architect that we had here, who came to talk to us about designing creative spaces. But can you expand on the whole idea of context?
Yeah, I definitely can. And I will say, like, actually, when what you should do with on a first date or whoever is, you should actually go look at puppies. Because puppies trigger oxytocin.
Good to know. I will keep that in mind. Funny because my one of my partners, Milena, she's like, you pretty much only do things, you use people's advice to, like, you know, apply to your own life for your own personal gain. I'm like, yes, of course.
Yeah, no. I mean, so like a great space example is that in New York, I'm writing a piece on this now. In New York, there's a place called the Petite Puppy. And what's really funny about the Petite Puppy is that you can go and watch all these women or gay men, typically, who are going to look at the puppies because the puppies are so cute. And then you can watch all the women or gay or the men or gay men or women who are there to, like, just to pick up the people looking at the puppies. Because if you're like looking at a puppy and then you look up, you're basically looking at the love of your life because the puppies trigger oxytocin. And then there's a bench that's there to, like, for people who just want to watch people picking up people who are looking at puppies. And so what's funny about that story is that that's a space story, actually. It's like, you've got a little unseen ecosystem. You think it's just cute puppies, but it's way more sophisticated than that. And that's like,
I love that.
You only see that if it's like, if you spend 10 minutes watching it, you'll be like, wait a second, there's something entirely different. And the owners know this. That's why they face this bench there, so people can watch this happening. Basically, my perspective on space, I'm an architect by training, is that spaces have set the script already. So you can go to court, and it's going to be pretty hard to reset the script of the way a courtroom functions, right? I mean, it's like it's been established for certain kinds of conversations. You can take the trial out of the courtroom, and you can have a completely different outcome. But the courtroom itself establishes the parameters of the way it works. And that's true. That's obviously a really kind of obvious example. But that's true of boardrooms. That's true of AA meetings. That's true of, like, your own kitchen table. I too, am an adamant believer in space. I love space as a way into these conversations because everybody has them, or everyone's been in them. And so, you know, it's like people might not understand that products are designed. Like, I had no idea that people design products. I thought they just fell off trees when I moved to IDEO. But people by inherently know, like, space. And they may not design the space the way you want their space to be designed, but they're designing the space the way that they want it to be designed. So they're just like, really, as I talk about in the book, space sets the script. And what you don't want to do is unwittingly play to someone else's script that you don't want to. Because the other interesting thing about space, and sorry, we'll get to circles in a second, is that, this is a great segue into circles, is that mnemonics use space to make memories. So our brain associates a space with certain memories. It's why I can say, where were you on 9/11? And you'll remember. And it's why, for instance, if you were in bed, waking up, you may not want to have conversations with your lover or partner at the same time in bed, even now, because it's like that space might be haunted by the mnemonics of what happened during 9/11. Just out of curiosity, I mean, where were you 9/11? Can you remember?
I very distinctly remember I was on the 101 freeway driving from San Francisco to Milpitas to go to the job that I hated with a passion.
Yeah, I was in the Mission Safeway parking lot going to Pete's. I was about to go on Drive Time Radio, which I was like sickened by. And I was like, I wish anything would happen so that I didn't have to go on Drive Time Radio. And I walked out and everyone was crying in the parking lot. And I was like, what's going on? And I got a call from my publicist being like, they don't want you on Drive Time Radio this morning. So it's like, but I mean, like, that's it. The mnemonic element is like, the space is tied to it really rigorously. And so what you want to do is make sure that you're resetting the mnemonics or establishing new mnemonics. It's why I sort of suggest, like, have hard conversations over breakfast or go for a walk or, you know, do things like that. But it's also, like, I'll say really, really honestly, in the COVID era, you'd think this doesn't matter, but it really does. Like, My husband and I, for instance, at the end of the day, I insist that we make the table, like set the table together. And it makes him crazy, but I'm like, all your cables, he's an AI artist, and like all these little robots and gadgets and whatever, get them off the table. Like, it's like, take the computers off, take the phones off. We're going to put down a tablecloth. We're going to sit down. We're going to, you know, set it. And he's just like, this is ridiculous. I'm like, no, we're setting the table for the conversation we want to have. And so even now there's basic things about the ways that you're establishing it. Like the spaces that really matter. So.
So, I mean, in the interest of time, there's one other area that I wanted to cover, and I'm hoping that we can talk about constraints and change in the context of this, principles for conversations in a virtual world. And I thought the best way to do this would be with an actual practical example. So every week, or I think every 2 or 3 weeks, we host office hours for our community of you know, Prime members, basically, which is our paid membership program for people who want to make ideas happen. And I was thinking about this because we do this Zoom meeting. And so I was like, okay, wait a minute, you have expertise on this. So how would we, you know, like incorporate change and constraints into that? And also the principles you talk about for conversations in the virtual world, which I realize I'm asking like 6 questions in one.
No, that's cool. Tell me how many people are coming to those conversations.
You know, I mean, it ranges from 10 to 15. So they're not massive, but they're not tiny either. And so I'll tell you right now what the structure is. It's kind of, you know, hot seat where everybody tells us, you know, what they're working on, what their challenges are. And then my community manager and Milena and I offer feedback and, you know, whatever we know to be able to help them get past that.
Yep. So, I mean, it's like that sounds pretty good. So like, it's like you're starting from a good place. I mean, as you know, like, so what's interesting about the four little principles for the, how to have, it's really like how to have the hardest conversations over Zoom during a pandemic, which I had to write in an afternoon because I had written these principles March 1 when my teams went on, when I knew we were going to go online. And that chapter is kind of a recap of the entire book. It's like, I think it's kind of like a film trailer because it's like, it doesn't give away the whole book. I kind of love it. By the way, we have that as an excerpt that we can send to you and all your listeners. So if it's okay. Interesting, it's just 4 pages. Yeah. So I think it's pretty useful. So let's just go through what those four are. And then I'll tell you how that, so basically it's commit or don't, which should sound familiar. And it's basically like, now the best time in the world. If you can't help a conversation go forward, then step out of the conversation and make more time in your life. That's totally cool. And so it's like, if you had gotten on and were like, I don't have time for this, I'd be like, fine, like we'll do it some other time, or we'll never do it. Except if you're the only voice of difference. And so I think if you're like, you're the only Black woman at this big financial organization, like you have to figure out how you can stay in. Except for when you can't, like if it feels really unsafe, then step out. So, you know, that's the nuance is like, everybody's like, just give us the one tip or trick. And I'm like, well, here's the tip or trick, but only until it's no longer applicable. And it's the opposite. Like, I don't want you to hurt yourself in any way, right? Like, it's like conversations are amazing, but they can also be dangerous places. So it's that. And right now I think, you know, with my teams, I was like, day one, there's wildcard days. You guys have a bad day. Today I'm like, I thought nobody would want to do anything. And everybody's like, no. I mean, I'm doing Life Hacker after this. And like, they're like, we want to talk more than ever today. You know, it's like, so what's interesting is that, so that's the first one. The second one is break the rules, all the rules. So that goes to the constraints. So the constraints was always about breaking the rules or setting and resetting the rules. And my first premise was like, these aren't like normal conversations. You can break every rule, right? So it's like, it doesn't really matter. It's okay. And so it's a good moment to be experimenting with the rules that you have. The third one is asynchronous is okay. So I talked about the fact that like being in a Google Doc with somebody can feel like you're in a conversation with them. Like my editor and I are so comfortable in Google Docs that like, he'll be like, hey, you know, there's something wrong with your brain. And I think that's hysterical. And it's like, as though I was just sitting and talking to him. And then the last one is get real about designing the human in. And so one of the things we lose through these mediums is our humanity. And so you might have to kind of purposefully design that human in. And so, for instance, when I do lectures right now, like I did a lecture for a big organization in Berlin, or I'm doing one for Creative Mornings, which is Tina Roth Eisenberg's thing. I'll have my husband just drop in and say he loves, hey, tell Creative Mornings that you love them. And David says, hi, I love you. And like, and that's pre-planned. It's me kind of like purposely designing the human in. And so, which is something that I think you need to do in all cases. So I think that's those things can be helpful for you. I think with what you're doing, it sounds like it's almost a kind of therapeutic practice in the way that you're going at, which I think is a really nice thing. I think let's go to like the change thing, which is that what might be really good is, as you know from reading the book, the chapter on change, is that change only works if you notice when it's happened, right? So it's like when you see somebody kind of shift their perspective, or you see, if you're giving somebody a piece of advice and like you see them actually kind of take that piece of advice in. And so what you might do is consider having one of the people who works with you just sit and watch the screen and sort of see if like watch for people who it looks like they've taken that something in and they're like, oh wait, there's something there. And so that's kind of like a witnessing. And then call out like, oh, Susan, it looks like you experienced a kind of a realization, as I was saying. Do you want to talk about what just happened? And that's a really important thing for us to do right now, because it's like, unless it's explicit, it's always hard to spot change when it happens. But now in a Zoom context, unless you're like really looking for it, you need to kind of ask for it. So that's one thing that I might consider thinking about, whether or not you might add a role or add a tool or add a rule that basically is saying like, when I feel changed, I'm going to call it out. Or if I feel like you're changing, I'm going to see if that's true. And the reason that's important is that it's that change that allows the group to kind of then activate to go to the next step, which ultimately is creation, which is kind of like, as you know, the last final chapter is really like, it like just make, you know, and actually the short line of the chapter, the last chapter is, if you can't talk, then just make. Like, I mean, there's a lot of other things in that, but the reality is, let's say you can't talk to your Trump or Biden voting relatives, then don't. Like, just make together. Or, you know, I have one person who listened to one of my lectures who's been telling me that she asked her father-in-law to teach her how to play golf, even though she doesn't want to learn how to play golf, but it's the way for them to connect and communicate now. So, just something to bear in mind, given the weeks and months we have ahead, which is going to be, you know, it can continue to be as challenging as we can imagine.
Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. I have so enjoyed talking to you. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Say that one more thing. What is it? What do I think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable? Is that right?
Unmistakable. Yes.
Well, so I'm gonna tell you a little story, because we have like a couple minutes, like 3 minutes or something. Am I right? So, yeah, I'm gonna just tell you. So,
yeah,
gonna tell you my favorite story, which is my great grandmother's story. So, my great grandmother she was a steel worker by night, and a farmer by day, and she used to come home in the mornings, like, and then have to feed all her field hands, and then actually like go from there. And she told me the story while we were sitting on a little bench or a little swing in the backyard. And she basically said, one night I came home in the morning and I was walking up the long drive, and I could gradually see this blue thing hovering in the air above me, and it was getting closer and closer. And I remember thinking, I have no strength to go on. I'm probably going to have to lay down the weary load, which is the kind of thing my grandmother would say, great grandmother. And then I realized it was Jesus, and he winked at me, and I was able to go on. So that, to me, is an example of a perfect story, because it tells you everything you need to know about her, and yet it tells you nothing, and it leaves you with a complete surprise. And it's like, it's the best cliffhanger ever, right? And it's like, it's got like the twist that like that we like from Black Mirror, you know. It's like, but it also tells you about her values, and it tells her that she's a religious woman, and that's how she persisted. And then if I add to that this fact that like she called me Hollywood all through my my 8 through 10 years. And she did that, I think, because she knew I was gay. And for her, Hollywood was a way to kind of acknowledge my gayness. So what I would say is that kind of elemental, pure human story is unmistakable. You can see my grandmother's soul in that story. You can see who she was in that. So I really ask you to start to practice those stories. Like, tell a 30-second story. I did a lecture for the Media Lab that was supposed to be like 55 minutes. And I was like, hey, I'm going to give you 50 minutes and I'm just going to tell you how to teach you how to tell a short story. And I did it in 5 minutes and gave him back the hour, which was like, I have to say, a complete and utter stunt, but it was pretty awesome. But anyway.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your wisdom and insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your book, your work, and everything else that you're up to?
I think the easiest way to go is makingconversations.com. Obviously buy the book, and then obviously subscribe, because we're coming up with a little WhatsApp curriculum. It's going to be like 30 seconds of video that prompts you to do something every day. And I think it's going to be really fun and easy. And then there's all kinds of other information about me, about my work, and about my team is not up there yet, but I've got a genius team behind me that's making this so much more fun.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member, who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.